This is KBLU-LP in Logan. My name is Richard Arlen Blake, and I would like to welcome you all back to the next episode of Bailadish Anish, or Folklore Now, the show of all things folklore. And today I would like to start with a little bit of tradition that dates back many centuries in the land of England. The day of November 5th is recently here upon us, so it is a day not much thought of here in America since the Revolution, but it is still a day of significance in other lands. 'Twas the day when Guy Fawkes attempted to blow up the Parliament building after the ascension of King James VI of Scotland to the throne of England. So let's think back to those days back in 1605, when that scheme unfolded, the scheme of Guy Fawkes to blow up London's Parliament. Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. A stick and a stake for King George's sake, we hope it'll ne'er be forgot. Well, some of you may recognize most of those words from a movie titled V for Vendetta. Of course, the words that V used were a little different in the second stanza than in the one that I just quoted to you here. And like all poetry that has spewn up from the masses, this particular poem does have more than one version. And the version that contains the words of V is a little bit older, since it deals with King James. For some reason, this one, the first one that I read to you, talks about King George, and the earliest King George to take the throne happened long after the gunpowder plot. But having said that, let's get back then to this particular poem that V quotes, and that really makes a little bit more sense for the time period. Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. Guy Fawkes and his companions did the scheme contrive to blow the king and parliament all up alive. 60 barrels laid below to prove old England's overthrow. But by God's providence, him they catch with a dark lantern lighting a match. A stick and a stake for King James' sake. If you won't give me one, I'll take two. The better for me and the worse for you. A rope to hang the Pope, a penn'orth of cheese to choke him, a pint of beer to wash it down, and a jolly good fire to burn him. Halloa, boys, halloa, boys, make the bells ring. Halloa, boys, God save the king. Hip, hip, hooray. As we can see from that poem, they do have a great feel of flamboyance. And burning effigies of the Pope has always been a part of that particular celebration, at least up until the current century. I'm not sure how often they burn effigies of the Pope. I have seen someone burn an effigy of Guy Fawkes. I don't know if they were just trying to be cute or if they're continuing a tradition, but that is the way it is. So, to celebrate the foiling of Guy Fawkes, you know, people all over Britain and Northern Ireland do these bonfires and burnings, and we always need to keep in mind modern day views and feelings about this as well. I'm not sure how modern day Catholics in Britain see it. That is something that I will have to check up on, because some might consider this an insult to all things Catholic in the British Isles, because Catholicism is no longer banned. Like so many other holidays that commemorate special events, you know, historic events that change the course of history, Guy Fawkes Night, a lot of people don't always realize where it came from. They just think of it as a time for celebrating, setting up fireworks, and doing all these other things. So even some people who you'd think might find it offensive might just not even know where it even came from.
let's just say, you know, in America, a lot of people just come and celebrate Mardi Gras. You know, that is a Catholic holiday celebration. But a lot of people just show up in New Orleans or they show up in Galveston, Texas. They just go there to party. The whole reason for its celebration is really either over their heads or they don't care. They just like to go and party. And I definitely noticed that when I was in Galveston in Texas, too. So I've been to several of these places where a lot of these events do take place. But moving on from Guy Fawkes, so I've done my first interview here with someone that I'm going to play here for you. This particular person, her name is Rachel. She is part of the folklore program here at Utah State University. She is going to discuss the kind of research that she is doing for her folklore project and where she wishes to go with it. And so we will now go to her interview and play that for you, and then we will discuss other things later. I am here with Rachel. She is also from the folklore program at Utah State University in the graduate program. She's here to talk about her research that she is doing that is concerning women within the LDS faith, the ones who go and they serve missions in the field and why they do it. So what is the basic idea that you are trying to get across here by doing this research?
Right. Well, I was reading some information. I was actually reading a speech by a folklorist, Bert Wilson. He is actually kind of considered the father of Latter-day Saint folklore. And it's interesting because he was talking about how what he's done in his work, and he studied three Nephite legends, which are legends about there's three ancient people who were told that they wouldn't have to die. And so people think they see the three Nephites, and you hear legends about that. And he was talking about his studies and what he's done, and he was saying that he thinks that folklorists are probably more familiar with three Nephite legends than even members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, right? And he was saying that he hopes for the future that folklorists who study Latter-day Saint folklore will study more of what's just the common everyday thing that matters to people of our faith. And so I thought that was really interesting, and I think that applies a lot to what I am studying, which is the Latter-day Saint woman and how she decides to serve a mission, or how she decides not to serve a mission, right? Because that's such a gray area. There, we're not told that it's bad if you don't go, or that you're super good if you do go. It's completely up to us.
As opposed to what the church encourages.
Yeah,
the church.
Exactly. And men, obviously, you still have your choice, and you're not kicked out of the church if you don't serve a mission, but it is, you know, more strongly encouraged. It's kind of the idea of, like, it's your priest obligation. There's more doctrinal foundation for that. But women, it's, you know, it's up to you whether you want to or not. Which it kind of leaves an interesting space, I think, for folklore to take place, I guess, like a folklore process for women to decide, right? Because it's just super personal how they decide to go on missions and what really prompts that and how they go about making that decision. So I think it's a really interesting way to look at women in a certain religion and how they, you know, how choice and agency factor into the religious beliefs and how that plays out in the specific setting.
Okay. Are there any examples of stories that you've come across so far about this, whether that's written or people you've talked to?
Yeah, you know, I was first inspired by my sister, actually. I served a mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and so did she. But it was really her story that first really got me really intrigued, because I was there for the whole process. I had just come home from my mission, and she had never wanted to serve a mission, not because she didn't have faith in the gospel, but because she just didn't really think it was for her, didn't really feel like she needed to. And then, interestingly enough, I kind of said something like, hey, maybe you should consider it, and she really looked up to me, so she took it seriously. And then just just interesting things in her life led her to the place that, even though she still didn't want to go on a mission, she still, like, didn't want to. She knew it would be hard because missions are hard. She realized, like, hey, I think this is what God wants me to do, and I feel strongly that it is what he wants me to do, even though I actually don't want to go. And I think that's a really interesting concept because, you know, normally you would think that those things would align a little bit more. You know, what you would think that ultimately, it would be your own logic that would kind of make you be like, yeah, you know, I want to go and it's right and it's what, you know, God or like a higher power wants me to do. But interestingly enough, and I found that for other women as well, that a lot of times they don't necessarily want to go, or they think they never planned on it, and then all of a sudden, or slowly over time, they kind of like, oh my gosh, I think that I need to go. And I just think, whoa, what's happening in between that point, you know? Or for people, even like myself, like I was summarizing for a different project my process of how I decided. And honestly, I always thought like, yeah, I could go, or I probably will go. And then I did. And I felt like, fine. I'm like, yeah, I really want to go on a mission. And I felt good about it. But interestingly enough, when I tell my story about that, I always factor in that with how that played out in the rest of my mission, because I wanted to go so badly, I felt so good about it, and my mission was really hard. So that really played into kind of, hey, this is where I was before, and I kind of went in, you know, with innocent, well-intentioned, but like naive ideas about a mission, but in the end, you know, I still, even though it was hard and not what I expected, and I went in with different ideas than what I came out with, it factors into my story of faith. And like, hey, I know I went to the right place and did the right things, even though it was not what I expected. So I think that's interesting too, because my narrative of how I came to decide to go on a mission, even though at the time it was easy, like it factors into the things that I learned and how I look at my faith now. It totally plays a part in that. And so that's a really interesting role with that. But that narrative plays as well.
So have you noticed any changing attitudes about women wanting to go on missions as opposed to like 10 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
20 years ago?
Definitely. It's hard to say. I haven't done studies across the board, but I know even just culturally, like, as I think you mentioned, the age for women to go on missions used to be 21, right? And then in 2012, October 2012, they changed, the church changed the age for women to go to be 19. And that was a huge deal. And I think that's another thing I'm looking at too, is because before it was kind of like, hey, you know, 21, you maybe by that point you're married, or you're in a relationship you want to continue, or, you know, you're in the middle of school in college. So it's kind of like, hey, if you're still around and you're still available to go and you're thinking about it, maybe then. And so a lot of girls and women would think, okay, well, we'll see what happens when I'm 21. You know, there's so many factors. But now that the age changes, and now that the age is 19, there's not as many, you know, excuses. Hardly any people are really married or feel that deeply committed, or you're right at the beginning of school. It's a good time anyways to take like a gap year or two. So I think that makes it kind of like, oh, there's not really any excuses, logical things to prevent me from going. So now I just have to face myself, and I have to face my faith and what I want and what I think that God wants. And so I think that makes a huge difference for sure.
But there's still less of a need emphasis on the women going as opposed to men going on missions. Have you talked to many of the women who are recently going on missions, or is that still something that you have to get started on?
I haven't done a ton of official interviews, but I have definitely. I mean, it's my scene. People in my, you know, ward congregation. I know that there again, there's no official doctrine or statements from the church. In fact, there are official doctrine and statements saying, hey, it's up to the woman. It's no pressure. You should not feel obliged to go. And also, you should not feel like you need to not go for some reason. And so from the church, there's nothing. But I do think that, especially with the age change, I'm sure that there, I know that there are women who feel pressure almost in a way, or kind of feel like, hey, all my friends are going. Wouldn't it be so cool, you know, if I went too? It just sounds exciting to, you know, possibly go to a foreign country and do something cool for, you know, a cause that you believe in. And so I do think that there are probably times, especially in the beginning there when that age change first happened, that women kind of feel, hey, maybe I don't have faith because I don't feel like I should go. And I'm sure that's definitely, I know that's definitely an issue for some women, that they feel, I don't know, they feel different pressure from different sides. It used to be, you know, oh, I feel pressure not to go because my family wants me to get married or I should stay in school. But now I think there could be a reversal of, I should go because why not? Like, I don't even know what I'm doing with my life anyways. I know I would have gone when I was 19 just because I didn't know what I wanted to do in college. And I was like, well, it's a good time to peace out and figure out what my major is later, you know. So that's a factor for sure.
So do you know where you're going to go with your research from this point? Like, what part of the process are you in right now? Where do you see your next step?
You know, I still have to do a lot of interviews. Again, because I'm part of the culture, I hear things all the time. I know my own friends' basic stories of how they decided, you know, how they decided to serve. But I will be definitely interested when I sit down one-on-one and get the long versions. You know, there's not always as many excuses or reasons to, like, hey, sit down and tell me your longer version of the story. But I'm excited to hear that. And I think I'm going to let the interviews speak for themselves and kind of take me the direction that I find them going. I don't want to come in with too many ideas, you know, and force them upon my interviews or interviewees, you know, well, how does choice play a factor, or like some kind of biased approach. I'd prefer that I just see where the interviews, what they say and kind of where they end up going. I'm sure I'll find patterns, or even when I was thinking, I'm sure there's a pattern between women who didn't want to go and then they decided, like, oh, I actually realized I need to go. And I realized there's definitely a difference between people who always wanted to go. And I'm sure that those will be different types of narratives and stories. So yeah.
You talked about, you know, being inside of the culture. Do you see yourself talking to any people, getting perspectives from outside of the culture while you're doing your research?
You know, that's always tricky, you know, the emic versus edic approach. And I definitely think there are many benefits to being inside the culture, but I've definitely, it's interesting because folklore, Latter-day Saint folklore, there are kind of an equal number of folklorists that are in the church and not part of it, and so there's a lot to draw from there as far as drawing from folklorists who have done studies that are not members of the church, or just other folklore theories in general that don't specifically apply to Latter-day Saint folklore that I think would still be relevant to use for sure. Obviously, I'm basing it off of that folklore theory. So.
Okay. So to wrap things up, do you have anything else that you'd like to add here about your research, or that you'd like people to know?
I guess going back along with what I said in the beginning that Bert Wilson said, I personally really like to focus on the everyday, day-to-day folklore processes that people of various folklore groups participate in that they may not even be aware of. I definitely think there's obviously a place for legend studies and other things like that, you know, where it's like, here's like a really unique, specific thing. But I just really think that there is value to see, hey, what's this process? You don't even realize that, you know, you're kind of creating your own way and you're doing things kind of in a folkloric way that everybody is participating in, that I think it's easy to say, oh, look at this nutso, like, three Nephite stories or end of time stories, which are so interesting to analyze and see how do they play a part or where do they fit into the role. But I definitely think it's important to look at, hey, what do people care about on a day-to-day basis and what are they doing about what they care about? You know, that's not prescribed. That's just on their own.
Okay. All right, Rachel, well, we thank you then for coming in, and good luck with your work. As you can see, the studies of the folklorists can be quite diverse. It can go into many different directions other than just stories or music. Folklore covers so much that really nobody can study everything. That's why we always zero in on what interests us the most. Now that we have spoken with a few fellow students in the art of folklore, I'd like us to return to another place. Let us now return to the sea, for in the end, all things originate in the sea, and all things may return to the sea. So next, what I would like to do is, I want to tell you a story. Yes, I want to tell you another story. And this one, of course, is close and dear to my heart. And I might explain why that is at a later time. This has been told in many ways, but then, you know, that is the nature of the folk tale. It starts at the port of Boston, in the port of America that has some of the richest history, the greatest history of maritime culture that I've come across. And that's not exaggerating, because there's just so much that's interesting there. So here's how it begins. On a spring day, the schooner known as the Charles Haskell set sail out of the Boston harbor to sail up the coast towards Canada. This ship, as it sailed up through the waterways, it eventually found itself in what is known as George's Shoals, that is between Cape Cod and Nova Scotia. While that ship sat anchored there, a hurricane came and struck the area, causing the waters to toss all the ships back and forth, up and about, and as a result, the Charles Haskell was yanked from its anchor and thrown out across the bay towards one of the other ships that sat anchored there. And that ship was named the Andrew Johnston. When it struck the side of the Andrew Johnston, the Charles Haskell split that ship in two. Then it sank to the bottom. The crew of the Charles Haskell were horrified what happened to the Johnston, for they were fellow sailors, and sailors do not like to be the cause of another sailor's death, especially an accident like this. But what was even more horrifying was what happened next. For the next time the Charles Haskell sailed up through George's Bank, through George's Shoals, it was evening, and it was dark. And as they crossed through, suddenly they heard a cry coming from out of the sea, and then out of the water climbed the ghostly crew of the Andrew Johnston. Terrified, they watched as these ghostly crewmen came and took control of their ship. They began sailing that vessel across the waters of George's Bank, and for several hours they controlled the ship and led it in many directions. But then, finally, at the sight of a lighthouse shining brightly upon them, the crew that had seized control of the Charles Haskell returned back to the sea where they came from. Everyone there was horrified and felt in awe. From then on, nobody would ever crew that ship again, for that ship was left to rot on the wharfs off of Nova Scotia's banks. Truly, this is one of the remarkable stories, for it's an actual event that happened, and there are many witnesses that attest to it. But of course, there are always those who scoff. And for those who would scoff, what we would say is, talk to any crewman or any sailor who knows the truth of that story, and when they hear what you have to say, this is how they might respond. That you may smile if you mind to, but perhaps you'll lend an ear, like men and boys together, looking back 50 years, who've sailed upon the ocean in a summer's pleasant day, like wise in stormy weather, where the howling winds do rage.
You may smile if you mind to, but perhaps you'll lend an ear, like men and boys together, looking back 50 years. Who sailed upon the ocean in a summer's pleasant day, likewise in stormy weather when the howling winds do rage. Well, I've tossed about on George's, been fishing in the Sound, in south in early summer, wherever fish are found. I've been in different vessels to the western banks and grand, likewise in herring vessels that have sailed to Newfoundland. I tell you when things were looking blue. Somehow I always made it, somehow I got through. I ain't no boast, however, I won't say much, but then I wasn't easily frightened like most other men. One night as we were sailing, beware of land away. I never shall forget it until my dying day. It happened on the Grand Dog Watch. I felt a chilly dread come over me as someone was calling from the dead. Right over the rail they came silently one by one. A dozen hardy fishermen, now wait, I'm not done. Their faces pale and sea-worn, ghostly through the night, and each took his station as though it were his right. They all moved together till landed heave in sight, or rather shall I say it, we saw Cape Hogue light. And then those ghostly fishermen all went to the rail as one. They vanished like the morning dew after the rising sun. Fishing with upon George's shoals. Well, now you've heard my story, and it happened as I've said. I do believe in spirits, and it's from them I feel I'm led.
So many stories do get presented in rather interesting ways. The story of the ghostly crew, ghostly fishermen, dates back over 150 years. It pretty much began, they first started singing this song back in 1874, which, interestingly enough, is 8 years after the event is reported to have taken place. And that is pretty quick as far as songs go, folk songs depicting a historical event. And a lot of these sailors, every time this ship would go out, it's purported to have happened more than once. As I said, every time when the ship had gone out and gone to George's Bank, these ghosts would appear and take over the ship. And some people said that that happened once before it got sent to the docks to rot away. And others actually said, well, it happened several times before anyone really gave up on the ship itself. So it is really interesting sometimes to note how stories come about and what happens when they are put to music. Because the story itself, the original story, actually is a little different than the song. Like, the number of sailors, according to one of the historical accounts, is that there were actually 26 of them and not 12, as the song says. The number 26 is 13 times 2, and sailors, being superstitious as they are, they do not like the number 13. And 12 is a nice rounded number. It shows a sense of completeness. For us folklorists, we always look for those little symbolic things that are part of just about every folk song. I love this song because there's actually about 10 different versions of that song that I have found. A couple of the ones that I've found are almost identical to each other, but there are some where just little tweaky differences appear, and or some words are changed, like the number of years in which the sailor singing the song had been at sea or sailing the seas. The version in this song says that he has been sailing for 50 years. Well, there's another version of the song that actually says for 40 years, and people could attribute, well, 40 years is actually more of a negative number, because 40 years is the number of years the Israelites wandered through the wilderness, and when the flood came from Noah, it rained for 40 days and for 40 nights. Now, 50, on the other hand, that's a nice rounded number. It has much nicer anecdotes, references to it throughout history. There's 50 days between the Passover and the Pentecost, and there's a couple others I can't think of off the top of my head. But you can easily study these folk songs and look at them symbolically the same way that you look at other, you know, stories or different versions of a story. And when a song is different from the actual original story, that's when I really love to delve into it. I think I'm going to bring this short to a close after this. That song, I felt, was a good touch to add. And there is one more thing that I do want to tell you, however, before I go. Because of the timing of which I started this podcast and what it is right now, I wished everyone a happy Guy Fawkes night. I hope everyone did have a good Guy Fawkes night. It has come and gone. And I have made a note of going and looking to see how everyone had celebrated it. But there's another day that has just come as well, and that is Veterans Day, or Armistice Day. And I hope everybody really understands what it is that we're celebrating on Armistice Day or Veterans Day. We are celebrating the end of World War I. It was a horrendous, horrific event. And it changed the lives of so many people. So many people died. And it's always good to remember them. Of course, we call that day Veterans Day now in order to honor all veterans, whether they fought in World War I or not. I think we should all remember that before this armistice, people were not quite sure how the war was going to end. The Allies were starting to push back against the Germans, who were the main enemy who was still around at that time. This armistice prevented a lot more deaths from happening than could have. There are several World War I poets that really let you understand what it was like to be out there on the battlefield. But I'm not going to talk about Sassoon or Owens or Graves or any of the other World War I poets. I will leave you to check that out yourself. I think you'll find their poetry very enticing and interesting and informative. As I close out, I do want to also say that I am always looking forward to hearing any stories that any of you have to say, any songs that you would like me to discuss that you think are worthy of note, or if you have recordings of yourself telling stories or singing folk songs, if you could send those to me, I would love to play them on this show. Just be aware of what it is that you are sending, because it needs to be something that is radio friendly. I guess I'll end just by saying, send me your things and send them to folklorenow33@gmail.com. That'll get you to the Bale Edition-ish email that I can look at. And I hope you all have a wonderful holiday season. Thanksgiving is coming up as well. I might have another broadcast by that time, but in case I don't, I want to thank you all now for listening, and I hope you all have a wonderful Thanksgiving.